I received some questions concerning the December 26th earthquake and tsunami that we're all well aware of. And since we are giving to the relief efforts for that this morning, it seemed good to me to address this subject this morning. I just think that the questions were asked were ones that probably a lot of people have, and you might like to hear these and maybe some scriptures that we could look at in response to them. So I want to read the whole list that was given to me, the whole question. But I detect three questions within it, and then I'll come back with those three questions and we'll deal with those. Don, with all the recent news about the earthquake and tsunamis, how the media makes sure we see bodies and hear numbers and we hear words like tragedy repeatedly, I've had some questions come to mind and I need to know if I'm out of line. I honestly and sincerely seek to know if my thinking needs to be readjusted. Christians have record of God using natural forces even to a global flood with only 8 being saved. Is it not possible that unfortunately he still has to use such extreme measures to get our attention? It is the same God with the same desire for the human race. Rather than focusing on the bodies, should we not be focusing on the souls? There are brothers and sisters in all parts of the world laboring to bring the gospel to everyone because we know that God desires that none should perish spiritually. If we focus on souls and desire what God desires, can we not use this force of nature or force of God to pray more earnestly for those that are seeking to teach the lost, to pray for more brothers and sisters to be willing to leave the comforts of home, to go where God would have them to teach, to become more aware of supporting evangelistic efforts individually and through the congregations we attend, to provide monies for Bibles and even more mindful of why we are all here to begin with? Christ said he came to seek and save the lost, so we should be doing no less. And in fact, with the images of all these bodies before us, we should certainly be more aware that we don't know the way or the time, but physically we are all going to die. Everyone is being asked to open their checkbooks and contribute for humanitarian aid, and that is not a bad thing. But shouldn't Christians be opening their checkbooks to ensure support to those missionaries that are throughout the world, laboring to teach? Shouldn't we be about making sure that those that are being taught have a Bible of their very own? Shouldn't we raise a loud cry if our congregation makes any attempt to trim evangelistic efforts or missions supported from the budget because there is a shortfall in giving? With the billions of dollars that were just spent on Christmas gifts, can any of us say we received or gave something that was worth more than a soul? Not one of the people that died took anything with them to their final destination. Is that one of the things God is trying to make us understand? Are our hearts heavy, not because somebody died, but because we don't know their final destination? I've already heard if there was a God, things like this wouldn't happen. It could not be that God is showing us how truly ripe the fields are to harvest, and that we must be about praying and harvesting. Please, if I am wrong in any area of my thinking, I need to know. Thanks. And I'd like to add that this did not come from anyone in this congregation. It came from another place. But I detected three basic questions, and this is what I detected them to be. Is it not possible that, unfortunately, God still has to use such extreme measures to get our attention? And the second one is, rather than focusing on the bodies, should we not be focusing on the souls? And the third one, which I'll reword for later, I've already heard if there was a God, things like this wouldn't happen. And then when I'm done dealing with those questions, I want to deal with how we can respond to this disaster. First, I want to consider some technical matters. As George has already pointed out to us, this massive movement of water is called a tsunami. From two Japanese words, su, well, that's the T-S-U, meaning harbor, and nami, meaning wave. And the T is silent. Just don't even look at the T, and that makes it a lot easier to say that word. It is not a tidal wave. A tidal wave is a wave that comes in with the tide. A tsunami is a seismic sea wave. Something caused a great movement of water, such as an undersea quake or even a storm. Moving the water, not just on the surface, but from the sea floor all the way to the surface, this water is moving at 450 to 500 miles per hour. It is barely visible at the surface. But since it goes from seafloor to the surface, when it approaches land, the land slows it down and it pushes up, and that's why you finally get the wave as it crashes in. Some people are saying that this is the greatest natural disaster in modern times. But when I first heard that, I remembered of a huge earthquake in the 1970s in China that killed anywhere from 300,000 to 750,000. And the reason we don't hear so much about that is because it is a communist nation, so we don't get much information about it, and there's not all these videos and missionaries and all the things over there in China like how we have with the Indian Ocean. Now let's deal with those questions. Is it not possible that, unfortunately, God still has to use such extreme measures to get our attention? First, I would like to ask, is God using this earthquake tsunami? To say that God causes something and that God uses something are two different matters. Does he ever cause such things? Well, history recorded in the Bible shows that God did cause some, but not all, natural disasters. For example, he caused the great global flood of Noah's day. And he did so to wipe out the wickedness that was on the earth and to save Noah and his family. God caused the 10 plagues that fell upon Egypt during the days of Moses to demonstrate his power to the Egyptians that they might let Israel go. Did God cause this earthquake tsunami combination? We cannot know. Did God do it? We just don't know. He didn't tell us whether he did. He didn't say that he didn't. We just don't know. And sometimes we can't know how things are operating. For example, in the letter to the man by the name of Philemon in the New Testament, a little tiny book, Paul was not sure if Onesimus, who was a slave who had departed from Philemon, had done so because of God's doing or not. He just didn't know. And he says this in verse 15 of that little letter. For perhaps he departed for a while for this purpose, that you might receive him forever. The point of comparison between the tsunami and the escape of a slave is that Paul, although inspired by the Holy Spirit, did not know whether God's hand was in it or not. He said, now perhaps, meaning perhaps it was, perhaps it was not. But that doesn't matter. It happened. Now let's see what we can do to make the best of the situation. After Adam and Eve sinned, death entered the world. And what that means is that natural laws were changed in order for it to now be possible for there to be death in the world. The flood of Noah's day was also a tremendous event that changed natural laws from pre-flood days. There were now climatic and earth changes that enable huge earthquakes and tsunamis and other natural disasters to be able to happen that could not have happened before. Can God use this earthquake and tsunami? In John chapter 9, the Bible reveals that a man was not blind as punishment for his or his parents' sin, but as an opportunity for good to happen. I want to read several verses from John chapter 9 to see the question that Jesus was asked, how he handled the question, what he then did, how people confronted the man who was born blind, and how it all ends up. John chapter 9, starting at verse 1, says this. Now, as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned? This man or his parents, that he was born blind? Jesus answered, Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. Okay, so this man is not being punished for his sin. He is not being punished or reaping the consequences of his parents' sin. But then Jesus said, he was born blind that the works of God should be revealed in him. Well, what does he mean by that? Let's continue to see what happens. Verse 4. I must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. The night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. When he had said these things, he spat on the ground and made clay with the saliva. And he anointed the eyes of the blind man with the clay. And he said to him, Go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which is translated sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. Skipping down to verse 16. Therefore some of the Pharisees said, referring to Jesus, This man is not from God, because he does not keep the Sabbath. Others said, How can a man who is a sinner do such things? Verse 24. So they again called the man who was blind and said to him, Give God the glory. That's a pivotal sentence in this chapter. The Pharisees say, Give God the glory. And that's exactly what's happening up to this point. They are discussing God. They are talking about whether the man was born blind as punishment for his sin. In other words, did God do this? The Pharisees are discussing whether Jesus is a sinner or whether he's from God. Others are concluding, well, listen, he can't be a sinner because he wasn't able to do such things. God's already getting the glory. But they say further, Give God the glory. We know that this man is a sinner. Now the blind man says, Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. One thing I know, that though I was blind, now I see. I can't argue with that. Verse 30. The man answered and said to them, Why, this is a marvelous thing, that you do not know where he is from, yet he opened my eyes. Now we know that God does not hear sinners, but if anyone is a worshiper of God and does his will, he hears him. Since the world began, it has been unheard of that anyone opened the eyes of one who was born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing. Verse 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and when he had found him, he said to him, Do you believe in the Son of God? He answered and said, Who is he, Lord, that I may believe in him? And Jesus said to him, You have both seen him, and it is he who is talking to you. Then he said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Why was the man born blind? God was not punishing the man. Whether God even caused it or not, Jesus doesn't address. But this man is born blind that God may be glorified. Jesus is going to use this opportunity to do a good work to this man so that God will be glorified, and that's exactly what happens. All these people are talking about God and what God does and doesn't do, and with whom he works and with whom he does not work. And then they start talking about Jesus. Is Jesus from God or not? Excuse me. And the chapter ends with God being glorified through his son Jesus, who healed this man of his blindness only by the power of God. So, can God use this great disaster that happened a few weeks ago? Yes, he can use it. Can we Christians use it as Jesus used that blind man? Yes. We can also use this disaster in others, no matter how great or small they are, to bring glory to God, to help people see God, and hopefully, especially, to cause people to believe in Jesus, that he is the Son of God, that they might be saved. The second question was this. Rather than focusing on the bodies, should we not be focusing on the souls? Well, whether we like it or not, large body counts get our attention. They just do. God has used large natural disasters for that very reason in the past. Remember again the flood of Noah's day. Or remember the 7 years of plenty and then the 7 years of famine that is recorded in Genesis chapter 41 and the chapters following. God used a natural disaster to get people's attention and to work things the way he wanted them to be worked. Now let me ask you this. Was anyone else murdered in America outside of Pennsylvania, Washington, D.C., and New York City on September 11th, 2001? I tried to research that, but it's impossible to do because if you get on the internet, and you put, if September 11th appears in your question, it immediately takes you to the terrorist attacks. I wanted to be able to give you some figures and say, yes, in Colorado, someone was murdered that day. But I couldn't figure out any way to do that. I checked the FBI. I did all kinds of things. It was a very difficult task. But here's the thing. For the people who were murdered that day, other than those 3,000, is there a benefit concert for the survivors, for the surviving family members of that murder victim? Have memorials gone up? Well, let's say since that day, since September 11, 2001, have we acted kinder toward others as a result of some murder? Now, I'll tell you what, I don't know about you, but after September 11th, or even actually starting that day, I was different. I tried to be a kind and gentle person, but the place where I really noticed it was out on the road, because I think that's the place where Americans can be the meanest. But I noticed on that day and for several months following, people were just nicer on the road. But why? Because a large body count got our attention. You know, a murder here, a murder there, it just doesn't get our attention the same way unless it directly affects us. Have we acted kinder since any murders in Josephine County that may have occurred since that day? I don't know. Did others drown on December 26th, 2004, or since then? Well, I'm sure there have been some drownings throughout the world, or even here in America, maybe even in Oregon, or maybe even in our county. But has there been the same outpouring of love for the survivors of that drowning as there have been for the tens of thousands who drowned on December 26th? See, the point is that yes, large numbers of bodies, whether it's right or wrong, get our attention. The fact that this disaster happened does get us discussing souls, and it brings up concern within us in ways that smaller numbers just don't. Yes, we should think of the soul above the body. Think of the ministry of Jesus Christ. Jesus knows everything. Have you ever realized that when he came to the earth and he had a ministry that lasted only 3.5 years, that in that 3.5 years, he could have revealed to us the cause of every single disease? Some of you have had cancer. 2,000 years ago, he could have said, here's what causes cancer, and here's how to cure it if you get it. He could have done that. My kidney disease was focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. I would love to have known what the cause of that was and then the cure, so I'd never have to say that big long thing again. But he didn't do that. Why? Yes, he took care of some bodies, but generally speaking, that's not why he came. His primary work was for souls, to enlighten souls and to save souls, and he dealt with people's bodies to show that he could help them in their souls. And he also did it to get their attention. And we could do the same thing. We can help people with their bodies to show them that we are especially equipped. The church is even more equipped to help with souls than we are bodies. And that's really what we want to do, is to enlighten souls and to save souls. And sometimes in order to do that, we have to help the body first. And with an opportunity like this one, it's great. And we should not miss an opportunity like that. Finally, the third question, which this individual said, I've already heard, if there was a God, things like this wouldn't happen. Or to put it in the form of a question, if there is a God, would things like this happen? Whenever I hear something like that, I always ask myself, who is it anyways that made up this standard that says if there is a God, bad things wouldn't happen? But it sure is a prevalent opinion, because it's been in time past. It's in the book of Job, where there's a debate rages about that. Sort of a related question, not exactly the same. But and it still goes on today. If there is a God, suffering won't happen. But here's the way that it truly is. Please think with me on this. If there is a God, there will be suffering. Now, I know that sounds a lot different than what we're used to hearing, but I believe if you really think about the way the Bible is written and how God has operated from the time of Adam and Eve, we can say if there is a God, there will be suffering, and here is why. The God of grace extended time and opportunity to Adam's race after his sin. That means that sin and death entered the world. If he did not allow suffering, it would be because the moment Adam and Eve sinned, he wiped them out and he destroyed the earth. Hence, no more suffering. But because he's a God of grace, he didn't wipe them out. He allowed them to continue. And they had children. And well, you know, here we are today. But here's the point. When they sinned, they also brought something with it into the world. And that is death. Therefore, suffering exists because, I know this sounds odd, but it's because God's showing mercy by allowing the world to go on. Although sin and death are here now also. It's interesting that this question often comes up about God's existence or his power and concern during times like this. Why do people think of him in this way? Why do they think of him at all during these times? I often wonder if it's not so much that they're trying to say he doesn't exist, but he does exist. And they know that he exists. And that's a hard thing sometimes to deal with. Disasters have a way of reminding us of our helplessness. And that angers some people towards God, and it drives others toward God, to where we all respond differently to these things. Therefore, perhaps a better question would be, why did God allow humanity to continue after sinning? The truth is, you know, we want to sin, yet we want to continue to enjoy a trouble-free environment. God, give me my free will. Give me my free choice. Yes, I'm going to sin, but make sure there's nothing trouble that happens in this world. In Romans chapter 5, Paul, an apostle of Jesus Christ, argues that sin does not come into the world by itself, but it brings a friend with it. And the friend's name is death. Romans 5, verse 12 says, therefore, just as through one man sin entered the world, and death through sin. And thus death spread to all men because all sinned. Now, here's the thing. God warned Adam and Eve ahead of time. If you sin, you're going to bring death. And they went ahead and sinned anyways. Maybe we should be asking, why did they sin when they had it so easy? They only had one prohibition. I think God was being pretty good to them. And He's being pretty good to the human race that He's given us the time that even after we've sinned, He doesn't destroy us. He allows us to go on so that I can have the opportunity to repent and I can turn to Him. But the fact that there is sin in this world also means there's death in the world, although death and the different things that happen, the horrible things that happen, may not be because of my sin. It's just the way the world is now. The earthquake tsunami is the result of simple natural laws. Consider, first of all, what I've already mentioned, that sin and death enter the picture. Secondly, the earth was transformed by a massive global flood. In order for that flood to take place, there had to be a 40-day and night rain, which means that there was at one time, and I believe this is supported by Genesis chapter 1, more moisture, far more moisture in our atmosphere than there is now. And that made life much different. That was one of the things that contributed to the long lives of the people before the flood, when they lived 800-900 years. Also, thirdly, the earth was transformed again by the measures that God put into place to prevent another global flood. I'd encourage you to meditate on your own this week. Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9. It tells you what God did to the earth, sinking the oceans down deep, sinking the valleys of the earth, raising up the mountains, raising up the landmasses to prevent another worldwide earthquake or flood. In order for that to happen, that causes great climatic changes, tremendous weather changes that they never knew before the flood, and other experiences that they didn't know. And fourthly, the earth is wearing out. The Hebrew writer said that in Hebrews 1:10-12. He said it's wearing out like a garment, and God's going to roll it up at some point and throw it away. Now, what happens when things wear out? Well, I took a suit to the cleaners the other day that for some reason I pointed out to the people there that the shoulder pads have gotten all crumbled up. Well, I've never had a suit do that. I don't know why I did that. And then as I looked at it sitting there on the counter, I thought, oh man, this suit looks really bad. It's getting really old. It's getting old. It's wearing out. And that's the very example that God uses in Hebrews 1. The earth is like clothing. In fact, I got this from somebody who wore it out. Now I'm wearing it. They fall apart. You have to have it fixed, and it gets to the point where it just breaks down and you can't use it anymore. Well, in the same way, this earth is getting old. And one of its signs of age is that over there by Indonesia, there are two huge tectonic plates. One is moving, the other is going below the other and kind of at an angle, and it moves 2.5 inches every year. Well, on December 26th, it moved 50 feet along a 745-mile line and did that all at once. And that just causes the water to move, and it kept on going until it hit land and unfortunately hit many, many people who were in its path. So finally, what can we do? Well, as far as money, in Acts chapter 11, the Bible shows what the early church did. They were able to learn ahead of time that a famine was going to happen. Did the brethren fret over what the government was going to do, or did they do something themselves? Well, they sought to do something themselves. So in Acts 11, starting at verse 28, here's what we have. Then one of them, named Agabus, stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, each according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea, because they had it especially bad there. This they also did and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul. And here we are seeking to do the same thing. First of all, the church here is going to take $10,000 out of our bank account, and then plus what you give today in designating for this relief, and put it on top of that $10,000, and this week that'll be sent to a congregation in North Carolina where they have a man working in a particular part of the Indian Ocean that we believe we could help and do a lot of good. And if you did not know about today because you've been gone or you're a visitor and you want to help or something like that, as Brother Don Easter mentioned earlier, you can give that to one of the elders or you can give it to one of the deacons, and we'll see that good is done with it. And it will be used to help Christians, to help others, that all may be done to the glory of God. You can certainly also pray for the well-being of all victims and the opportunity that this gives the church to show the world why they should not try to silence us as the secularists are attempting to do. The only place free of disasters is heaven itself. The last passage I want to give you this morning is Revelation chapter 1. Listen to what it says starting at verse 1. There is a time coming. There is a God. And He has created a place for us where disasters such as what we've just seen will never happen. Here's what it says in Revelation 1, starting with the first verse. Now I saw a new heaven and a new earth. For the first heaven and the first earth had passed away. Also, there was no more sea. So the first earth, this earth is gone, he says. Then I, John, saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from heaven saying, Behold, the tabernacle of God is with men, and He will dwell with them, and they shall be His people. Now here's how personal it gets. God Himself will be with them and be their God, and God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There shall be no more death. Read that as no more 9.0 earthquakes, no more huge tsunamis, nor sorrow, nor crying. There shall be no more pain, for the former things have passed away. But He who sat on the throne said, Behold, I make all things new. And He said to me, Write, for these words are true and faithful. And He said to me, It is done. I am the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. I will give of the fountain of the water of life freely to him who thirsts. He who overcomes shall inherit all things, and I will be his God, and he shall be my son. But the cowardly, unbelieving, abominable, murderers, sexually immoral, sorcerers, idolaters, and all liars shall have their part in the lake which burns with fire and brimstone, which is the second death. Yes, there is a disaster coming. John just wrote of that. But it's going to be restricted to one place. And we can avoid that disaster. On the other hand, he says there's another place where God will wipe away the tears. Now, I think that's interesting. He makes it sound like God personally will wipe away the tears. When you were a little child and your parents rubbed your eyes or wiped your nose, you hated it. But imagine now, you've gone to heaven, you have tears, and God sees those tears, and God Himself comes to you and wipes them off your cheek. Wow. Save the tsunami victims and save your soul. Do it today. If you want to be saved, if you know what to do, or if you don't, we'd be glad to explain that to you further. Come forward right now, please, as we stand and sing.